This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes Monday and Thursdays.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Science Weekly is supported by Rainforest Trust. In honor of this year's Earth Day, we're promoting Rainforest Trust's Brazilian Amazon Fund throughout April. Rainforest Trust is a 501c3 organization, which means that 100% of all money donated goes directly to conservation efforts. The fund has already helped protect more than 6.5 million acres of rainforest habitat, but Rainforest Trust still needs to protect a further 13 million acres to reach its goal. You can help. Donate online at rainforesttrust.org/earthday this April, and your generous gift will be quadruple matched for the Brazilian Amazon.
It's been another busy week on the science desk here at The Guardian. The James Webb Space Telescope brought us a glimpse of a possible water world a mere 70 light years away. A controversial new theory of gravity could get rid of the need for that elusive substance, dark matter. And the UK's science minister has apologised after posting false allegations about an academic on social media.
The science secretary falsely accused an academic, Professor Kate Sang, of supporting Hamas. These were comments that she was forced to retract in a statement earlier this week.
So today, we're breaking down some of the biggest stories of the last 7 days. I'm The Guardian science editor, Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly. I'm joined by science correspondent Hannah Devlin. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, Ian.
This week, you reported on a really interesting theory that could completely rule out the need for dark matter, something scientists currently think makes up a hefty chunk of the universe. So what is dark matter?
Well, I mean, in fact, we don't really know what it is. Its actual nature is completely mysterious. But one of the strongest pieces of evidence for it is looking at the way galaxies rotate. So if you think about our own solar system, we have the planets going around the sun, and there's this balance between the velocity of the planet, the kind of speed it's moving at, versus the gravity that's pulling it in, and that gets it to go around in an orbit. And as you move out to the edge of the solar system, the gravity is weaker and the planets go slower. And so astronomers had assumed that the same thing would be true when you kind of took a whole galaxy, that the stars at the edges of the galaxy would be rotating much slower than the stars at the middle. But the stars at the edge of the galaxy are going way faster than they ought to be. They're going so fast that they ought to be just being kind of slingshotted off into space. But clearly, they're not going flying off into space. So the inference is that there must be something putting that gravitational force on them to keep them in place. And so astronomers thought, well, there must be this invisible mass kind of in a halo around galaxies that we can't see, called dark matter. And there are other lines of evidence from other kinds of astronomical, you know, observations, but that's one of the most compelling ones.
And scientists have been looking for dark matter directly and indirectly for many, many years now and have come up blank so far. But now the actual existence of dark matter has been called into question by this new theory. What's actually being suggested?
Yeah, so this is quite a controversial theory, I would say, fairly left field, from a professor at University College London called Jonathan Oppenheim. He was trying to work on a theory that unites quantum physics and basically gravitational theory, which are the two main pillars of modern physics, if you like, that both work really well in their own right, but are fundamentally incompatible. So there's this ongoing grand objective of uniting these two theories. So he'd been working on this essentially mathematical theoretical framework that brings these two things together. And this latest paper, he's turning this theory to the question of galaxy rotations. And he finds that his new alternative theory of gravity can explain the rotation of galaxies without the need to kind of come up with this mysterious dark matter substance.
So what is he actually proposing? What does this theory say about, you know, the sort of structure of nature, if you like, which means we don't need dark matter anymore?
Okay, so clearly this is all very mathematical. I can't go into it in great detail, but there are a few sort of fundamental points that of his theory that we kind of can describe. One of them is that he's thinking about what the nature of space-time is. And often these theories that try and unite quantum and gravity, they suggest that space-time, which is kind of the structure of the universe, has to be seen in a quantum way. It has to be seen as though if you zoomed in, there would be like a smallest piece that you could get to and it could be broken down into units. He rejects that view. He sees space-time as classical. So it's like a fundamentally smooth, continuous surface, basically. But he introduces this idea of wobbliness. The rate at which time is flowing is kind of fluctuating in time. So it's almost like a burbling stream. It's kind of rippling up and down. Space as well is subject to these sort of warped in unpredictable ways, you know, on a very small scale. You wouldn't be noticeable if you were just walking along the street. I think, you know, it's fair to say this is a pretty fringe theory at the moment. It's not mainstream, but it's also not, I think, you know, people are engaging with it, and it seems to be explaining something that it wasn't designed to explain. That it was designed to do something else. That's possibly quite surprising.
So you've talked to Jonathan Oppenheim at UCL about this theory, his theory. What about other scientists? You've spoken to other physicists. What do they make of it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, it's a little bit left field. For example, two very well-known theoretical physicists, Carlo Rovelli and Jeff Pennington, have got a 5,000-to-1 bet with Jonathan Oppenheim that his theory is wrong. I spoke to Jeff Pennington about this latest paper, and he said, you know, he doesn't see anything in it that changes his mind. He's still kind of sticking to that bet. I think, it'd be really interesting to see how this theory fares when it's tested out against other astronomical observations. But they have actually also come up with a more lab-based method that they think could be used to test the theory. And it's a team at Canada's Perimeter Institute who've designed an experiment that's supposed to uncover these wobbles in space-time that are being predicted. For example, if you take a standard 1 kilogram mass, you can look at tiny fluctuations in the measurement of that kind of mass. And if the fluctuations are smaller than a certain threshold, that would potentially rule out the theory. So they're basically coming up with ways already that you could do this in the lab. And Ian, moving from fundamental physics to health, you wrote about a really quite alarming study this week, which was all about microplastics and cardiovascular health. What did that find?
That's right. This was work from an international team which looked at the sort of gunk that builds up in people's arteries when they have atherosclerosis. It's a coronary disease where your arteries can sort of clog up. They get sort of furred with fatty deposits, basically. When they analysed the gunk in these plaques, they found evidence for microplastics and nanoplastics in them. So these are plastics that are smaller than a thousandth of a millimetre. First of all, that hadn't been found before. No one had found evidence of these micro and nanoplastics inside these plaques that build up in arteries. And these were the carotid arteries, the main ones that supply the brain and the face and the neck. What was particularly interesting about this study is when they looked at how these patients fared after this operation, you have this operation to remove this stuff from your arteries. When they looked at how those patients fared over, on average, 34 months, those who had the plastics in their plaques were 4.5 times more likely to go on to have a stroke, have a heart attack, or die of any cause in that study period. This doesn't prove that those plastics cause those cardiac events, but the evidence from cells and from animal studies suggests that, yes, these particles will cause inflammation, and that inflammation itself might be adding to the buildup of these plaques inside people's arteries, which is extremely worrying because this plastic pollution is everywhere. You can't really get away from it.
What do we know about how they get into the body? Is it in drinking water? Is it, you know, in foods that we're eating?
The plastics that they found were polyethylene and polyvinyl chloride. These are two of the most sort of commonly used plastics that are out there. And the particles are getting into food, they're getting into the water supply, they're in the air, and you're ingesting them or breathing them in.
Is there any advice about how we can protect ourselves from them? Or, you know, are there any treatments on the horizon to kind of wash them out of your body?
The researcher I spoke to was really keen that we sort of, you know, keep in mind the precautionary principle and say, well, look, we really need to ultimately start reducing the plastics that we're churning out and the plastics we're using. But he said, look, even if we could stop plastic production tomorrow, if this is a health problem, it will exist for many, many years to come because there's just so much of it in the environment, which will be breaking down into these tiny particles over the, you know, the decades to come. And so really the only options out there are reducing your own personal risk. And it's going to be reducing rather than stopping becoming exposed to these things. But, you know, and that involves things like hoovering your house quite often to make sure that, you know, plastic particles coming off furnishings and off carpets and things are not sort of just being suspended in the air all the time, and not microwaving meals in plastic containers because it sort of encourages plastic particles to get into the food, probably using tap water rather than bottled water. So just looking for where plastic is in your life. Hannah, there's some really intriguing news from the James Webb Space Telescope. And since you're our resident JWST expert, you can tell me about it. What have they found lately on this exoplanet TOI-270D?
They always give them great catchy names, don't they? So this is some new observations where they're looking at the atmosphere of the planet. So they're not just trying to spot the size of it or that it's out there, and they're trying to look at actually what it's made of. And they do this by looking at the way the light from the star, the sort of host star, is being filtered through the atmosphere, and they can pick out signatures of different chemicals. This planet, a team in Cambridge have concluded, is potentially entirely covered in a deep liquid water ocean, which is quite exciting.
Whenever we hear the idea of there being water on a planet, Hannah, we immediately obviously think of potential for life. What would the situation be on this planet? I mean, if there's water all around it, does that mean that there could be some sort of alien fish, alien plankton kicking around?
So, the team at Cambridge have been very cautious about this. They're not even claiming that it could definitely be habitable. And one of the reasons for this is that the planet is tidally locked, which means one face is always turned inwards towards the star. It will be permanently day on that side of the planet, and the other side is in sort of perpetual darkness. So certainly on the day side, the ocean, they say, could be at least 100 degrees Celsius. And because it's quite a high pressure atmosphere, the water could still be liquid, but be incredibly hot. So they're saying, you know, pretty much no for the day side of it. The night side, you know, potentially could be habitable, they say. But again, we're talking quite extreme conditions here with this kind of massive temperature gradient between the two sides. Now, it's worth saying there's another team in Canada that's been using the same observations who disagree with this interpretation. And they say that they think there's too much water vapour in the atmosphere for there to be also an ocean down below. And they also think that it's far too hot. So they've got a hotter estimate for this planet, which, you know, suggests it could be thousands of degrees. But it's a really good demonstration that, you know, James Webb is now able to make these really precise measurements of molecules that allow you to build up a picture of the likelihood of life. And, you know, without being able to go to a planet, you're not going to be able to, you know, picture whether it's alien fish or, you know, maybe little bacterial type life. But you are able to sort of build up a picture of whether the conditions are there, the extent of evidence for life being out there. And I think that's one of the things that people are really excited about with these latest observations. And just to finish off this week's episode, Ian, I wanted to talk about an interesting story that really gets into the relationship between politics, free speech and science here in the UK. What happened?
Yeah, this is actually really concerning. This is the case of the science minister, Michelle Donnellan, accusing two academics of sharing what she called extremist views on social media, and one of them of supporting Hamas. So last October, Donnellan wrote to UK Research and Innovation, UKRI, this body that oversees several of the UK's research councils, to complain about these two academics who were members of a new Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Expert Advisory Group. She expressed her disgust and outrage at their appointment and asked UKRI's chief executive to disband the whole working group. And Donnellan also published the letter on X, formerly known as Twitter. UKRI did do an investigation and found no wrongdoing whatsoever on behalf of either of these academics. And Professor Kate Sang sued. She sued Donnellan for libel. And Michelle Donnellan's department had to settle £15,000 that the taxpayer will be paying, not Donnellan. Although Donnellan hasn't admitted liability, she's withdrawn her comments. She's apologised for posting that material on Twitter, now known as X. And it's just a really extraordinary move by a science minister to make these accusations and then have to reel back because they were wrong, and for the public to pay the bill for that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it feels like there's sort of two troubling strands to it. One is this kind of direct interference with what should be an independent funding agency. And then the other is this increasingly divisive definition of extremists that feels like it's, you know, potentially going to be targeting certain groups. And I'm interested in how the science community has reacted and whether there's kind of one of those strands that people seem more worried about.
I mean, it's absolutely something that, you know, many scientists are concerned about. I mean, they see this as being a case of Donnellan basically starting or continuing a culture war of having a pop at academics. She certainly lost a lot of the confidence of the scientific community. I mean, there will be different views out there, obviously, but it's been seen as an extraordinary intervention. And there are people who, in the scientific community, who think she should be paying this £15,000 out of her own pocket, because why should the public have to foot the bill for a minister's really egregious mistake? And just a bit flabbergasted that the whole thing happened in the first place.
Mm. And you think it potentially is going to put some people off wanting to take those quite public roles on boards and heading up funding agencies if you're kind of subject to that sort of public showdown. I mean, you know, a lot of scientists won't be up for that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Michelle Donnellan was in front of the Lords Science Committee on Tuesday. And I have to say the committee gave her an extremely easy ride about this. I mean, Donnellan did begin her evidence by reading out an apology and by saying that she shouldn't have posted the letter on X, that it should have just gone privately to the UKRI to raise her concerns, which would have dodged the libel issue. But I think it does have this effect of almost like a chilling effect on academics who, even though Donnellan said at that committee, because she was asked, are academics under surveillance? And she categorically denied that. But there is a concern that, you know, is there observation? Is there some sort of, you know, effort in these departments to keep an eye on what academics are saying, maybe even particular academics, and to make sure that they're in line with what the government decides is the right way to think? That really is disturbing. And I think there are academics who, you know, you'd imagine are going to be cautious about what they say in future. Thanks to Hannah Devlin for joining me this week. You can find all of our science coverage on theguardian.com. Before you go, a reminder to check out The Guardian's new series on artificial intelligence. It's called Black Box. Today's episode looks at how AI is going to transform our lives in ways that will be extraordinarily positive. Imagine if there was a machine that could see cancer years before a human can. Search and subscribe to Black Box wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes are released every Monday and Thursday. And if you're interested in the latest developments in tech, make sure you subscribe to The Guardian's fascinating TechScape newsletter. Every week, journalist Alex Hearn takes a deep dive into how tech is shaping our lives. Sign up for free by going to theguardian.com/techscape/audio. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by Madeline Finlay. It was sound designed by Tony Onochuku. And the executive editor is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.